Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and it's great to have all of you joining us here again on disasterpodcast.com or maybe on your mobile devices. You're checking out the show. We do appreciate that. We have a great lineup for you tonight. We're full of guests in-house and a lot of good discussion coming up on some topics. And some of the topics are going to be a little difficult, I think, but that's okay because we need to talk about these things. Disaster response is not always kittens and rainbows, as we said here on the show in the past. And, of course, speaking of kittens and rainbows, it wouldn't be a good podcast without my esteemed co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how are you?
I'm good. I'm not sure if I'm the kitten or the rainbow, but either one isn't bad. How you doing, Jamie? You sound a little bit under the weather.
I got a little stuffy nose. It's not painful. It's just annoying as heck. And of course, it makes me sound like this. So apologies to everyone. We'll get through this.
Fine.
Yeah. And how things going with you out in Northern California?
It's good. It's been actually really nice. It's been quite warm. It's just perfect right now. I really don't want it to warm up much more than it is, even though I know that's not realistic. But it's really nice. So we're going to enjoy it while we can. And all the spring buds are coming out, and it's pretty cool. So it's good. But we have our infamous Dr. Joe Holly, and I guess it's warmer in Memphis now, too. Is it not, Joe?
It is. We've had a couple of absolutely spectacular spring days here, 70 degrees and sunny and absolutely beautiful. Nice change from last week when we had ice and snow on the ground.
God, and that was just a week ago, huh?
Yep. Well, it's Memphis. You know, give it 5 minutes and the weather will change.
You say that about California. Well, we also have who we have nicknamed the Sasquatch because we got to grab him as he runs by, our good friend Jim Logan. He's never going to live that down now. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Sam. How are you? I'll just talk about the warm weather. So the first person to say it's too hot gets punched in the nose.
Well, it's going to get a lot hotter. The two of them are in Memphis, but also in Baltimore, in Jamie's part of town, we have my friend Stephen Canarian, who we can call him another Sasquatch, because I've been trying to rope him into this podcast now for probably as long as we've been doing it. But Stephen's a particular interesting friend of mine, and how we met was kind of an interesting story, too, because when we first started the First Responder Network a few years ago, we had a little spot in the Zoll booth where we would stand and just talk to people. And one day, everybody else had wandered off, and this guy comes in. And I don't know how it came up that Ground Zero came up as a subject, but he wouldn't have had any way of knowing that I was there. And he started talking about the fact he was writing this book about Ground Zero and his involvement in it, but it was really focused on the EMS people there. And immediately I took an interest, and God love the firefighters. I live in their world and I love them to death, but the EMS people seem to have taken a back seat during this event. And I know there were a lot of EMS people who were unhappy about that. So I was thrilled immediately that somebody was taking this on as a project. And I ended up helping him do a little editing. And I just love the book to death. And Stephen's story is interesting anyway, because he worked on the EMS side of FDNY, as well as the fact he was involved in USAR. And of course, you know, with Jim and Joe having been involved in USAR, that's a good connection right there. So I'm sure you guys will have some questions for him. So Stephen, say hi.
Hey, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm really proud to have written the only book about Ground Zero from the EMS perspective. And to tell the story of EMS, and I think it's an important day in U.S. history, and it's something that's only going to get more interesting in time. I'm very proud to have written the book, The Downwind Walk.
Yes, and even the title, I'm sure Jim and Joe can appreciate the title. If anyone knows anything about hazardous materials, there's a point to be made. But I love the idea that you drew these characters for us and you told us about them. So why don't we start with you kind of walking through what you do in the book so beautifully. Walk through the day. What was it like when you came on shift that morning?
Well, September 11th was one of the most beautiful days I can remember. And that period of time was very peaceful. And I was working in the station in the box, and I was busy trying to staff ambulances and do paperwork, and the guys come in and say, "You got to turn on the TV, you know?" Because I'd seen it on the radio and on the computer, and I just kind of didn't believe it at first because we always deny things. And then when the first tower collapsed, I said, how crazy is it going to be having only one tower? And then we lost the second tower. I looked at the screen, and we had like 40 ambulances on the scene. And I said, you know, now we'll probably be on par with fire and police because we probably just lost like 20 guys. Little did I know that fire lost, you know, 343 total, two medics and the rest firemen and one priest. And it was really crazy. And the one thing that really sticks out initially was they called in all the hazardous, they call them HazTAC ambulances, ambulances that are staffed with EMTs and paramedics, and they're also hazmat. And I remember putting the extra equipment in the ambulance and the ambulance being staffed. And when they pulled out of the garage, I knocked on the back, gave them a thumbs up. And they drove out. The sun came in the garage. And I said, you know, this must have been what it was like in Vietnam when a plane took off. I really didn't know if I'd ever see them again. It felt like we were at war, you know. It was very eerie for an EMS lieutenant to feel like that and send people in harm's way. But, you know, and then eventually I got to go downtown. They wanted me just to abandon the station, but I said, I can't, I'm running the station. And it was so poignant when I went down to Metropolitan Hospital and me and Vinnie Johnson driving down to Ground Zero. If you've ever been in Manhattan, you know how traffic is. We were able to drive from 110th Street all the way to Ground Zero without stopping. And there were cops at every intersection waving you through. It was funny because I'm driving down there, and what do I look for? I'm looking for the Twin Towers. I see, you know, find my way down there. And he goes, what are you looking for? And I looked at him. He goes, dude, they're gone. So, wow. So we get down there, and I see Dr. Gonzalez from the Urban Search and Rescue Team. And, you know, this is 2001 during the day in Manhattan. And I said to him, what's the plan? He goes, there is no plan. I says, well, where's the guys from rescue that are on USAR? He's like, Steve, they're gone. We lost all five rescue companies, you know, all the specialty units, they're gone. And, you know, to think of the New York City Fire Department, you know, using buckets in their hands to look for their coworkers. And it was really, really weird to have no forward plan of action. It really was weird. And then someone yells out, hey, number seven's going, run. And I never forget, this voice comes out and says, stand your ground. We're the FDNY. We don't run. We're far enough away. Close your eyes and put your head down. And it was so funny because it was like you're praying. And this dust came right over our heads. And I was like, holy shit, we are in it now, you know? It was, and when you're writing a book, you know, you remember the things and you're trying to figure out what the title is. But I think the most poignant part of the whole day was when we were at the little base camp and we finally went downtown, went down to the site. We were like four blocks away and we turned the corner and there's a fire engine running. It was idling, you know, and there's dust inside the cab, on the back of the windshields, the newspaper and the fire lieutenant's glasses were there. The guy's uniform coats were on the seat and it was all covered in dust. So we went downtown. And then we came back the next morning. And then that night, we went back, and the truck was still running. And then we came back, the truck had run out of fuel. And it was like, I said, wow, there's a truck that's missing its guys. And you know, it's just amazing. You might lose a fireman or two, but you think you lost all five. I mean, that truck was, like, missing its guys. So we were down there. It was... I grew up wanting to be a firefighter so bad. And I knew about, you know, Chicago Fire. I knew about the Iroquois Theater. And, you know, to stand there and say, you see the Chicago Fire Chief come by. And he actually came up from underground. There was some metal moving, and he puts up a pike pole, and this deputy chief from Chicago comes up, and his assistant comes up. And I said, did you guys, you know, take the subway, or did you tunnel all the way from Chicago? And he goes, if you don't belong here, let us know. I will get out. I says, dude, you're one of the big 10 departments in the country. You belong here. This is like the Chicago Fire. And the chief says to me, Lieutenant, this is a lot worse than the Chicago Fire. And, you know, when you start seeing things like that and you see the American flag hanging from the building, you realize you're walking in the pages of history. And I was just so blown away to be at an event bigger than the Chicago Fire. So, and I had been at the two biggest homicides in U.S. history. One was the Happy Land Fire and the other was Ground Zero. So, you know, and then there was guys like Carlos Little and Ricardo Quinn that we lost. And, you know, I wanted Carlos Little to know what he was like. He was awesome. He was a cool guy. He was a good medic. He wasn't foolish. When we showed up, we saw his ambulance facing north on West Street. You know, the vehicle was off. It was out of traffic, the way you're supposed to stage, facing the nearest trauma center. And I wanted people to know what he was like, or Ricardo Quinn. And I interviewed people that worked with these guys. And I wanted to share the lessons of some of my buddies that were nearly killed. Like Joe Conzo, he got an accident on the way down to Ground Zero, a minor accident. And another vehicle was speeding down there with him. And he stopped to exchange information. And that other vehicle, they made it downtown. And that young lady, she perished from St. Barnabas Hospital. Miss Marino. So, I mean, these little happenstances, you know. And I grew up in Massachusetts and see a Massachusetts state trooper down there. I mean, they're very fearsome people. I saw that inverted triangle. I was like, what are you doing here? He's like, I'm here to save lives. I got a dog. I'm here to find bodies. I'm like, what are you doing here? He's like, I will shovel dirt. I will sweep the street. I will do anything. I said, I don't get it. You guys are like three states away. And this guy was actually shorter and younger than me. I was always looked to these guys. If you look at the Massachusetts State Police online, they have an SS uniform. That's where it comes from. And he looked at me and he goes, Lieutenant, he goes, I'm here because we're responsible for this. These planes came from our airport. And I says, wow.
Wow.
What do you think of this? I said, what do you think of this city? He goes, I can't comprehend it. I'm from Boston. And there's supposed to be two airliners here. I don't see them, any of them. It blows my mind. So I said to him, hey, you know, being a EMS wise ass, right, using humor to cope. I said, you want me to blow your mind again? He goes, it cannot be done. I says, I'm from Rehoboth, Massachusetts, which is a town of, like, when I was there, 4,000 people, where the ambulance did four calls a week, you know? He's blown away. He's like, well, no, you did it. So in seeing all these kind of happenstances, and always been a big advocate for EMS, and realizing we're walking in the pages of American history, I wanted to share the story, you know, and I thought it was really interesting, you know, and I've been very moved by the reactions of people, you know, who like the story, and there's just so many little, well, one of the, Jim will understand this, is, you know, when I grew up, I always thought firemen and policemen were buddies all the time. And that's not really sure in New York City. They're always vying for the dollar and the press. So the second night we're down there, it's pouring rain, and there's this lieutenant from emergency services, NYPD. They call him Fat Pat, big Irish guy. And he's talking to the deputy chief in charge of special operations for fire, and he's talking to the Port Authority, you know, admiral with three or four stars, and they're talking together. And it was like, wow, everything is perfect. And he comes back, he goes, fire doesn't want to go down there into the garage. We were trying to find a way to the subway because there was a story that there were like six cops in a deli with 11 civilians. Somebody had called it in erroneously. So we're trying to get down in the subway. And he goes, we're going to go down. A couple of guys from each department. And so they go down into the garage and they have Scott Packs and their CO detectors. And they come back and Fat Pat's shaking his head. And we're like, what's up? He goes, fire said he lost guys down there. He says, there's seven hoses that go off into the abyss. And they said there's probably four or five guys in every hose. And he goes, the CO is through the roof. The doors are racked. There's no way to go anywhere down there. And, you know, we went down there. We're expected to find people in a lean-to collapse, seven people, 10 people, rescue people, treat people. And gradually, the hope of helping people faded away like the smoke. And then you got to a point where you're like, well, we heard of one cop who rode the building down from the 70th floor and survived. And then it got to the nitty gritty. And we actually treated a rescue dog. And the stuff they had trained us and you saw worked. You know, they said the cop called us over and said, hey, the dog's shivering. I can't stop him from shivering. He's out of control. He's going to die. Help him. And I looked at him and said, they got like five coats on him. Why is he shivering so much? I lifted up the coat and they had put him on an I-beam. So we just put a blanket under him. And in a couple of minutes, he stopped shivering. And I was like, wow, Dr. Gonzalez and Chief Maniscalco and Chief Chalmanchano, they gave us good training. And we had good masks, too. You know, I am so lucky that I had that training in those masks. I can remember sitting in front of, you know, four World Trade Center one night and the cranes are working. And, you know, there's a rhythm. It's almost like a science fiction movie. One loader to the next, to the truck, the lights. And this black smoke comes right at us, acrid black smoke. And we're sitting there, you know, I get the mask on, I'm like breathing. So I turn to the sergeant next to me and says, you know, we should move. He's like, don't worry, brother. These masks will protect us from 30 different chemicals. And I looked at him and I said, my training, I remember being told the average house fire is 57 different chemicals. And I said, this is far from the average house fire. So I asked the lieutenant if I could go around the corner to the logistics place, wash up, get something to eat. And he looks at me, he goes, you're EMS, right? I says, yeah. He goes, yeah, go ahead. We probably won't need you, but it's good to have you around. So I remember going down behind a building. You know, there's no smoke. It was clean. I washed up. And even though those guys were sitting there, I knew better than to move. I knew to move, you know? Time, distance, and shielding are my three best friends. And I'm so grateful I had awesome training. And, you know, and when we first set up camp, when we're setting up the base camp, it's hard to understand, but it was like the city and the country was in a system. Are you guys there?
Wow,
we're here. We're just wrapped with attention.
I've had chills ever since you started, Steve. Keep going.
So, okay, I didn't know if my phone died. So when we were setting up the base camp, it was like the world was in asystole. Nobody knew what to do. So what happened? This is what I tell people. How do you prepare for the worst days in American history, right? You don't know, but you do know. What it is, it's not any particular training you have. It's all the training and all the special skills each of the guys have. So we're setting up the tent, and Jack Quigley comes over with a big bucket of water and a brush. I said, what are you going to do, clean up the whole place by yourself? He goes, no. He goes, this is the boot wash. Nobody goes into my tent without washing their boots, and coats go there. Because this guy's crazy. And Lou Madalena goes, no. We go camping. You don't bring muddy boots into his camp. So, and then I went and got some medications and equipment. I used to be ALS coordinator. A lieutenant started a log. We only got radios. And we just all kind of showed our own special skills. It wasn't any training we had. It was who we are. And so a couple of nights later, we're laying in the tents. And I look over. And one of the guys had his mask off, and when he was breathing, this, you know, dust going in and out of his mouth. I'm like, dude, you know, we would work for like 23 hours a day, and around 3 a.m, everything would just stop, you know. And he says, I can't go 24 hours a day with the mask on. And you know, we were 4 blocks away. But we really should have been, you know, 30 blocks away. And, I think that one act of what Jack Quigley did really helped many, many people. And it was the individual talents of every person that got us going. And I think we slowly paced Ground Zero, New York. And as we'd go down there, you'd see people waving and handing you big packages of Duracell batteries, the American flag, thank you. And I said to one of the guys, I said, I feel really guilty. He's like, why? I said, we're not really doing anything. He goes, yeah, we're trying our best. And in a time when nobody knew what to do or could comprehend, what we were at least trying to do something, you know? And I think that's how we got through that moment. It was awesome to witness something. So, you know, to be in New York City, to be no forward plan, and to see the skills of every guy, you know. And you know why there are no girls that died from FDNY 9/11?
No, I anybody didn't know that was the case. Uh-uh.
Yeah, because they're too freaking smart.
I love that.
Yeah, I love that.
No, a few that ended up career injuries, but
Miss Marino was the only one EMT who perished. And so there are 10 EMTs and paramedics from New York City that got killed, two FDNY paramedics. And I think proportion wise, EMS people were pretty good as far as and then, you know, I hate to say it, but there's a lot of stories I heard of guys who were with Carlos Lillo. And guys that were ordered to go in the building by chiefs and captains. And you know, I think it's hard for me to reconcile. I thought about it a long time. They were ordered to go in the building, and they didn't go because the building was moving. It was on fire. There was a jet airliner up there. And what it comes down to is, I think, I talked to these guys who were standing with Carlos Lillo and were ordered in and didn't go. Is I think, in command, although we're in charge, you have to be open to what you guys and girls are saying. And I think we all have to kind of do an egoectomy when you're a boss. And maybe you got to listen to your guys sometimes, you know?
Absolutely.
So I look at my book as if you look at Ground Zero as the heart, I look at the 12 leaves of Ground Zero. The septal wall and the anterior wall, everyone knows. But I look at this book as the lateral wall, the strongest part of the city, and what we did and nobody heard about. And I'm actually really excited because I've been selling the book at conferences, and I've been doing my best. It's an independently published book, and I'm really proud of it. I don't know if I told you, Sam, May 1st and 2nd, I'm going to Hollywood. I'm going to pitch the book to Hollywood. And
wow.
It's being carried at the New York Book Expo, the largest book show in the country. And it's my goal to meet Clint Eastwood and have him direct the film. And I want Denzel Washington or who was the American Sniper?
Bradley Cooper.
Brad Cooper. I want one of them to play me. You know why? Because color's not important, man. It's the character.
No, it isn't.
I saw freaking American Sniper 8 times because it's exactly like the story and what we dealt with. And I love sharing the story because I never believed in post-traumatic stress, and it kicked my ass. And if that can happen to a Bronx medic, it can happen to anybody. And that's why I love talking about it.
Well, I think Joe's been dying in the background here, and being a USAR guy, he's got to have a couple questions he wants to ask you.
Sure, go ahead.
I do. Thanks, Sam. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. You know, I'm sitting here reminiscing as I'm listening to you and thinking of how many similar experiences we had down the road away from you. But I guess one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking about the exposures and that sort of stuff is just sort of what kind of stuff you guys did in the weeks and months after the event. Obviously it went on for a very long time for you. In regards to all the potential exposures that you guys had there, was there a particular monitoring that you guys did? And can you talk to us a little bit about kind of what that monitoring looked like?
Okay, so to answer your question, there came a day when Ground Zero stunk like rotting flesh. And I said to Jimmy Booth, I said, what are we doing here, Jim? There's no people left to rescue. Jim Booth is now the chief of EMS for FDNY. And he said to me, Steve, we're here for the medics and we're here for the cops and the firemen who are doing the work. And this is very dangerous work, and it does them good to know there's a New York City medic here. So So I'm like, oh, okay, good. And then there came a time when they said, some of you guys have to go back. And I said, I'm a lieutenant, I'll go back. You let the medics stay and do their job. My station needs me. And I remember leaving, and sometimes I'm kind of a dull instrument, and I'm not really that forward thinking. But when I was getting in the truck, I said to myself, I just took 10 years off my life, and I know more people are going to, inherently, I just knew more people are going to die. I mean, I've dealt with asthmatics my whole career, and I said, you know what, more people are going to die. And in the book one day, I was so dirty after working for 3 days in the same uniform, I actually went and took a cold shower and kind of decontaminated myself. And as far as medical monitoring after, I have to tell you, in the 6 months after 9/11, there was none. And I have to tell you, I asked for time off, and I was told, Lieutenant, we got stations that lost 20 guys. You're not that bad. The whole system was... And I actually, in the book, I describe how I went to Baltimore to lecture at UMBC about MCI management, and it was then I realized I had the startle reflex. I was short. I was jumpy. A kid jumped on a skateboard, and I almost hit the deck. And my good friend Jason said, oh, no, you're fine. You don't have issues. Because I left the environment, I was able to really understand everybody had PTSD. So I went back to the station. I could see with fresh eyes why we're all fighting each other, why the public was fighting us. And I was like, wow, we are all, you know, let me be politically correct, messed up. And then they started focusing on the people who couldn't sleep and couldn't breathe. And, you know, there was some counseling. Then they started hiring professionals. And now they have 3 or 4 offices around the New York area to accommodate the fire department. And actually, this last winter, I probably had one of the hardest times that I've had. I just felt so isolated and... You know, I felt like nobody really cared. I felt like I was on a conveyor belt and nobody was really paying attention. And I called the fire department. I got an appointment and I went to talk to someone. I felt really good, you know. So things have really changed. I know there were some guys that did these cleansings. You know, I just so thankful to have that mask and to have that training. I think the best training I had during the whole thing was actually the terrorism awareness, time, distance, and shielding. Whenever I lecture, I tell them those are my 3 best friends. So I try to share those lessons. And, you know, it was tough. The system was decimated. The farm was decimated. I mean, you guys know we lost, what, 70 engine company trucks.
Yeah.
And folks, we are going to cut this episode in half because Steve was just giving us so much good stuff, and we wanted to give him an opportunity to continue talking about the difficult time he had at 9/11 and Ground Zero. And Sam, you know, there were times in this first half that I was just getting chills.
I had chills from the very first word, and I still have them, Jamie. And, of course, some of that relates to my being there as well. My experience was different, but it certainly I could relate to everything he was saying. So definitely come back, and you got to hear the second half of this because it's just amazing.
And so we're going to close out this episode, but we do want to make sure we thank our good friends, of course, Joe Holly and Jim Logan at Paragon Medical Education Group. They sponsor the podcast. They make it possible for us to bring this show to you each week. And we really appreciate their support so that we can continue bringing you the Disaster Podcast. So check them out. Head over to ParagonMedicalGroup.com or check them out on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. They're also on Facebook. But find them. Say thank you. Just shoot a thank you out on Twitter for sponsoring the hashtag Disaster Podcast. You know, they will get the message, and it's great to just show a little thank you to them and give them some support. We want to thank Joe and Jim for continuing to support us here. And Sam, you know, we couldn't do it without them.
And I'm so glad they were a part of this show. I mean, their experience at the Pentagon at the same time we were at Ground Zero and you know, with their USAR, it was so great to have them on this particular show, and their feedback was just amazing.
So anyway, we're going to go ahead and close out here, you know, Sam, and you will pick up next week. So make sure you come back and check out next week's episode with the second half of the Steve Kanarian segment on 9/11 and Ground Zero. But, you know, Steve, talking about the things he was talking about, Sam, you know, this disaster situations, even in situations where it's recovery and not rescue, it's still, you know, not medicine the way we think about it.
No, it isn't. And that's what disaster medicine is all about. It is not your everyday medicine.